Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Wade Henderson. I'm president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. The Leadership Conference is the nation's leading civil and human rights coalition, with over 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. I want to thank you all for joining us for another installment of our Calling for Justice conference call series. These calls bring together national, state, and local leaders for strategic collaboration on some of the most important civil and human rights issues of our time. On today's call, we have representation from local organizations from around the country, including the Atlanta Jobs with Justice, Jewish Community Action in Minnesota, and national organizations like the National Urban League, the National Women's Law Center, and so many others. We have brought you all together today to talk about an important opportunity in Congress to provide America's workers with a raise by increasing the federal minimum wage. The Leadership Conference is a dedicated partner in fighting for economic security for all Americans, and we believe that doing so is one of the most important civil and human rights issues of our generation. Now, as we all know, our economy isn't working for everyone. By many standards, times have never been harder for low-income people and people of color. Unfortunately, not everyone sees it this way, including House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, who shared today the House Republican budget that certainly does not offer any real solutions in this regard. The cost of living has increased, while wages have stagnated, or for some people, have been eliminated altogether. African Americans, Latinos, women, and people with disabilities lag behind in almost every indicator of economic well-being, including in poverty rates, employment, education, and health. That's why raising the minimum wage has been a defining issue for the civil and human rights community for generations. The 1963 March on Washington called for an end to segregation in education and housing, but also, and I quote, an increase in the national minimum wage so that men may live in dignity. Now, the marchers demanded a $2 per hour minimum wage, and in today's terms, that would be the equivalent of approximately $15 an hour. But unlike our predecessors, we're not asking for $15 an hour. The Senate is likely to consider the Minimum Wage Fairness Act in the coming weeks, an important bill that would assure that working men and women get a bare minimum of $10.10 per hour. And that is not a radical plan. It is a sensible compromise that the vast majority of Americans support, because raising the wage doesn't just help to pull working families out of poverty. It expands the economy for everyone. Now, before I ask our first speaker to briefly underscore why raising the minimum wage is important to her and to her organization, I need to remind everyone on this call that this is an off-the-record conversation. This call is closed to the media, so please treat it as a family conversation about this critical issue. Now, on that note, I now have the honor of introducing our distinguished speakers. Dara Richardson-Herron, CEO of the YWCA USA. Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa. Christine Owens, Executive Director of National Employment Law Project. And U.S. Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez. We will have the opportunity to take a few questions from the participants on this call, time permitting. And when the time does come, our operator will give us instructions before each Q&A about how to submit your questions. Now, I'd like to first introduce Dara Richardson-Herron, CEO of the YWCA USA. Dara is the leader of one of the nation's oldest and largest multicultural organizations promoting solutions to enhance the lives of women, girls, and families across our country and around the world. We are so fortunate to have Dara with us today to briefly discuss why raising the minimum wage is an important civil rights issue for women and especially women of color. Dara?
Thank you so much, Wade, and it's great to join you, Senator Harkin, Secretary Perez, and Chris Owens today. I'm particularly proud to represent the YWCA, an organization that's played a critical role for well over a century in advocating for civil and human rights and equality for all, with a particular focus on women. Over the years, the YWCA has been on the front lines advocating for workers' wages, shorter working hours, and better working conditions. And the YWCA was also one of the pioneers in providing a safe haven for women as they entered the workforce in the early 1900s. Even in 1938, the YWCA fought for the passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, which created a wage floor and minimum amount that employers would be required to pay workers, and also established the 40-hour work week. And that same year, the federal minimum wage was set at 30 cents an hour. Now, while the current minimum wage has significantly increased from 30 cents an hour now to $7.25 an hour, we all know that $7.25 an hour is not nearly enough to make ends meet for millions of low-wage workers who are working day in and day out to meet the needs of their families. And the YWCA continues to be a staunch advocate for policies and legislation that empowers women and families. And that's because leaders in our 227 local associations across the nation have firsthand evidence and experience of how a lack of financial stability, lack of financial equity, and abject poverty negatively impact the health and welfare of many of the millions of women, girls, and families served by our organizations across the nation. You know, many of the women who walk through our YWCA doors are at a crossroads in their lives. They're often at their most vulnerable point, and they're in desperate need of life-changing services. And in addition to the many other services that we provide, annually more than 500,000 women and girls come to our YWCAs to escape life-threatening violence in their homes. Raising the minimum wage is so vitally important for these women because we know that employment that pays a fair and family-sustaining wage is an essential element to help these women leave their violent homes and rebuild a life after abuse. Through our work, we've also seen a major shift in family dynamics. Many of the women we are serving are not only the primary caregivers, but they're also now increasingly becoming the primary breadwinners. Research has confirmed that 4 in 10 American households with children under the age of 18 now include a mother who is either the sole or primary earner for her family. Now, this percentage is the highest on record, and it has quadrupled since 1960. And this shift clearly signals the need to enact policies and create solutions that reflect and address the changing realities and challenges that women and families are facing daily. And for many reasons, raising the minimum wage is the right thing to do for both men and women, but it's particularly important for women. Think about it. Women represent nearly two-thirds of minimum wage workers. Women of color are disproportionately represented among female minimum wage earners. And here's another troubling fact. The federal minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 per hour, and this has been frozen since 1991, nearly 23 years. And women make up nearly two-thirds of workers in tipped occupations. Also, increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour, as Wade mentioned, would boost earnings from $14,500 annually to $20,200 annually, enough to pull a family of three out of poverty. And that's why our YWCs from Pittsburgh to Kauai are advocating for a higher federal minimum wage. We know full well that the women we serve and their families deserve a raise, and most importantly, we know that they'll benefit greatly from the enhancement in their economic and financial stability. As an organization committed to racial and social justice and women's economic empowerment, we believe strongly that it's essential to enact legislation to improve the economic security of all women and families, including communities of color. And from a moral standpoint, as one of the wealthiest countries in the world, we believe that reducing poverty should be a priority in the United States. And at the YWCA, we're counting on our elected officials and legislators and really each of you to help us continue our historic efforts to enhance the lives of women, girls, and families who without our assistance would have no place to turn. Our YWCA leaders across the country will certainly continue to advocate for solutions like the Minimum Wage Fairness Act and also continue our supportive services to help women face the many challenges they face daily. However, while we work towards a larger agenda, we want to do our share to make sure that women and families can benefit from a minimum wage increase right now. So as each of you on this call know, none of this will happen unless Congress acts. That's why we're so happy that you joined us today. We respectfully encourage each of you to support this vitally important and life-changing effort to increase the minimum wage. We also ask you to reach out to everyone you know to help strengthen our efforts. Call or email your senators this week and urge them to co-sponsor the Minimum Wage Fairness Act and vote yes on the bill. You can certainly count on us at YWCAs across the nation to continue the work we began over a century ago to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. And I can assure you that our collective efforts will go a long way to benefit the entire nation's economy and, most importantly, make the world a better place for millions of women, girls, and families who are counting on each of us to make a difference in their lives. Thank you so much, Wade, for giving me and the YWCA the opportunity to join you to speak about this critically important issue.
Well, Dara, thank you both for your insights and for your leadership. I mean, it's obvious after hearing your presentation that minimum wage is not simply a workers' issue, not even a women's workers' issue. This is a family issue. And I think you spoke eloquently and powerfully about why the minimum wage increase is an important civil and human rights issue. Our next speaker, I believe, is Senator Tom Harkin, if the senator has joined us on this call. Is Senator Harkin yet on the call? He'll be joining us in just a few minutes. We know that he has an unfortunate business meeting, which is running late, and so he has to complete that before he joins us, so we expect to see him momentarily. So again, just to confirm, Senator Harkin on the line. Okay. Well, I think in the interest of moving forward and before we take any questions, I'm going to invite Christine Owen, the head of the National Employment Law Project, to get a chance to give her comments and to join in this discussion. Christine Owen is the CEO, rather the executive director of the National Employment Law Project. She has done an outstanding job over the years, both in leading her own organization and helping to lead a broader movement of which the Leadership Conference is a part, promoting workers' rights, promoting a fair workplace, and certainly promoting the minimum wage. Chris, we're really so glad you're able to join us for this important conversation. And our other speakers today, of course, have already, at least in the form of Dara, Richards, and Heron, have already weighed in, and so we would welcome hearing your views on why the minimum wage is such an important workers' rights issue. Chris?
Thank you so much, Wade, and thanks to the Leadership Conference for holding today's call. And I want to try to avoid repeating everything Dara said in her great presentation. I want to emphasize that the federal campaign is a reflection of what we're seeing around the country. There is tremendous momentum on raising the minimum wage. Just last week, the state of Connecticut raised its minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. The state of Maryland's legislature is poised to vote this week. Hawaii is coming up soon. Several other states we anticipate will be following suit. And we are also seeing a number of cities that are considering proposals to raise their minimum wages to $15 an hour, which, as Wade pointed out, was essentially the demand in the March on Washington that we should raise the federal minimum wage to what today would be the equivalent of $15 an hour. And this is all in response to several things. One, the obscene expansion of inequality, the growing concentration of wealth at the top, and not just among the 1%, but among the 1/10 of 1% or the 1/100 of 1%. The declining wages for most workers, and that's particularly true for workers at the bottom of the wage scale. The disproportionate growth of low-wage jobs, which is a trend we've experienced for roughly 35 years now, but it has really accelerated during the recovery after the most recent recession. The recognition that raising the minimum wage will help tens of millions of workers, giving a vital boost to our economy overall, because these are people who are not able to park their salary increases in offshore accounts or spend them on frivolous things, but rather spend them on basic everyday necessities. And that kind of consumption and spending is vital to economic growth. And the other reason why raising the minimum wage has such momentum and has such resonance is because it is rejection is inconsistent with our values, the idea that anyone who works full-time should be living in poverty. That is not what Americans believe. And that is why in survey after survey, we find huge majorities of respondents supporting raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. In fact, supporting an increase to $10.10 an hour at higher rates than those who support raising it to only $9 an hour. We even find majority support for raising the minimum wage among Republicans. This is a bipartisan issue. It is a coast-to-coast, every region of the country issue. It cuts across every age group, every demographic group, every racial, ethnic group. It is a bedrock issue for most American workers that in a country in which we expect people to work for a living, that people ought to be able to make a decent living from work. And that's why we're so excited about the federal campaign. We think there will be a vote in the Senate within the next week or so. We think it is incredibly important that the Senate supporters hold the line on the crucial elements of the minimum wage, which are raising it to $10.10 an hour, which is the step needed in order to restore it to its historic value and actually make it a wage that helps move working families out of poverty. Raising the tipped worker rate wage to 70% an hour. I mean, 70% of the federal minimum wage, as Dara mentioned, it's currently $2.13 an hour, and it's been frozen at that level since 1991. And finally, indexing the minimum wage so that it rises every year as the cost of living goes up, so we don't have to go through these kinds of campaigns and fights and deal with this kind of recalcitrance among opponents every 5 to 10 years. It's critical that senators hear the voices of their constituents and the voices of folks like you on this call who really care about working people and care about decent wages. I want to give out a call-in number that folks can use to call their senators and demand a vote on the minimum wage and demand that their senators support raising the minimum wage. So that number is 1-888-851-1916. I think later in the call, Wade, we may talk about some other actions that people can get engaged in and some other activities that are underway right now. But for the moment, I just want to make sure everybody has the call-in number, which is 1-888-851-1916, and you're telling your senators to vote for the Minimum Wage Fairness Act.
Well, Chris, thank you. That is very helpful. Give me that number one more time. 1-888-851-1916. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, that's great. And thanks for giving that terrific information and the great presentation. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we've been notified by Senator Harkin's office that he's still running late. He's still in that meeting and unable to break away. He will join us as quickly as possible. And Secretary Perez, Tom Perez, U.S. Secretary, Department of Labor, is in a cabinet meeting this afternoon, hopes to be able to join, but you know how these things are, a bit unexpected. And so we've had two presentations, outstanding presentations from our colleagues, Dara Richardson-Heron of the YWCA and Christine Owens from the National Employment Law Project. And operator, why don't we take a few questions to see if anyone on the call would like to ask questions and before we move on to hopefully our next speaker. Justin?
And at this time, if you would like to ask a question, it is star and one on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question from the queue by pressing the pound key. Again, to ask a question, it is star and one, and I'll pause momentarily to allow questions to queue.
Great. And while we're waiting for the first question from the audience to queue, perhaps I can pose a question to both Chris and to Dara, and to really get your sense. I mean, I know a number of people on this call have heard about the toxic atmosphere here in Washington. Obviously, partisanship has made this a most difficult issue to pursue. And some are skeptical that even with the kind of momentum that seems to be building in the Senate, there's a question about whether something like a minimum wage can actually go through. Now, many of us feel that the kind of grassroots efforts that and grass tops effort that are symbolized by your participation in this call will help. But, Chris, I'm wondering if you might give us some insight on why you feel pretty optimistic that something will happen eventually with respect to the minimum wage.
You know, that's a great question, Wade, and I'm so glad you asked it. I've been doing minimum wage campaigns for the better part of the last 20-some-odd years, and the reality is we never start a minimum wage campaign with bipartisan support and enough votes at the very get-go to win it. It is always a dogfight, and it shouldn't be, but it always is, to get enough votes to move enough people who are opponents or who are maybe neutral on it, but they, for reasons of party affiliation or whatever, feel that they can't be supportive up front. It always takes a campaign. It always takes building momentum. We have a lot of support for raising the minimum wage. We believe that if we get 60 votes in the Senate, which we ought to get, because basically all that's saying is we need to be able to proceed to debate and vote on this measure. We believe if we get those 60 votes in the Senate, we will pass an increase to 10-10 an hour, 70% tip worker wage, and indexing in the Senate. We have 195 members of the House who have signed a discharge petition asking Speaker Boehner to bring the bill to the floor. Now, he said he won't do it, but the reality is there is almost no issue that is as popular and that people care as much about as they care about raising the minimum wage. And we see every time we have a minimum wage campaign that as momentum builds, that as the public gets more and more engaged, that we're able to peel off opponents or peel off people who are sort of lukewarm but don't want to step out at first, and get them to come over to supporting raising the minimum wage, supporting having a vote. We really only need to pick up, with 195 folks who've signed that discharge petition, we really only need to pick up about 28 or so additional supporters. And we think that we can do that, and history would suggest that we can do that, because when members of Congress go home on the recess in April, there are going to be actions in their districts. This is another way folks can get really involved. There are going to be actions in their districts that are going to focus on minimum wage and give us a vote and raise the minimum wage. And we think as this activity really revs up and as more and more people really are in touch with their members, both in the Senate and the House, there's more pressure for a vote. We think that we will see more movement, and we do not rule out the possibility that we will win a minimum wage increase this year.
Mm. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Justin, do we have a question from one of our callers?
We do. We'll take our first question from Sylvia Johnson with the United Auto Workers. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, Sylvia.
Hi, Wade. Well, I didn't have a question, but just more of a comment. First of all, thanks for putting this call together. And I just wanted to reiterate the UAW's commitment to joining the fight, particularly on the ground and in these congressional districts, on raising the minimum wage. Because, I mean, Chris is right. The last time the minimum wage got raised, it wasn't as though we had all the votes to get it done. But I just wanted to say to the group that, you know, this is an issue that's near and dear to our President Bob King's heart, and we are certainly, we stand ready to join the fight and do what we can to move this along.
Sylvia, thank you. Sylvia Johnson is a Washington representative of the United Auto Workers Union. it's terrific to have the UAW supporting this effort, and Sylvia, to have you working alongside us here in Washington. I was going to pose a question, Dara, to you about this as a women's issue, because you focused your attention in a way that I think helped shine a light on why women in particular have an interest in getting an increase in the minimum wage. But I understand that Senator Harkin may be calling in. Senator Harkin, are you on the line? Is the office on the line?
I just came up. Is this
okay? Yes, it is. How are you, Senator?
Hey, just fine. Listen, I'm sorry I'm late.
No worries at all. We're delighted to have you. And let me just set you up with a little bit of an introduction, and then we will go from here. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the privilege of introducing someone who is a dear friend, not just to the Leadership Conference, but to the civil and human rights community of long standing. Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa is the leading co-sponsor of the Minimum Wage Fairness Act in the Senate and a stalwart advocate for civil and human rights. He's joined us on this call. Now, in his years of service, Senator Harkin has dedicated himself to workers' rights issues, to education issues like the passage of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and the reauthorization of that bill, to labor rights issues, working on a variety of worker rights concerns, issues affecting persons with disabilities. He is helping to lead the effort now on Senate ratification on the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities and so many other issues of great interest to our nation and to the civil and human rights community. I'm also privileged to say that because of his incredible tenure and service, this is his last year in Congress, and I'm pleased to report that the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights has the privilege of bestowing our greatest honor, which is the Hubert H. Humphrey Civil and Human Rights Award, to Senator Harkin at a dinner, our annual dinner, coming up on May 15th of this year. And we're really, really pleased and proud that Senator Harkin has agreed to be honored that evening. Senator, it's a real privilege to have you on the call. Thanks for joining us.
Wade, thank you, and thanks for those kind words. And I look forward to the dinner, and I'm humbled by the fact that you would give me this award from the Leadership Conference, the Hubert Humphrey Award. He was one of my heroes. Actually campaigned for me back in the old days when I was running for office. I can tell you a lot of Humphrey stories.
I bet you can. Well, we'll look forward to hearing them. But let me say this. You deserve that award many times over. Thank you for being on this call. And we'd welcome your insights about how we really make this increase in the minimum wage happen.
Okay. First of all, let me just thank you again, Wade, for getting this. You got 240 local and national groups to sign on to this letter. Thank you so much. That letter is being delivered now or something, huh?
Yesterday.
Oh, it just came out yesterday. Okay, I knew it just happened. So I want to thank you for that. And I want to thank all the people who are up on this call. Look, you know, very rarely do we in the civil rights and human rights community have an issue that has overwhelming public support. This is one of them. I mean, we've got all these polls that have been done showing that 10-10 an hour, all voters, 73% support it, 90% of Democrats, 71% of all independents, even 53% of Republicans. I mean, this is like manna from heaven for us. I mean, we have an issue here that the broad swath of America supports, and not just supports a little bit, overwhelmingly supports it. State by state by state, I'm looking at them here, where in every state, well over 55, 60, 70% of the people support raising this minimum wage. It is a civil rights issue. As you all know, more often than not, it's people of color, it's African Americans, it's Hispanics, it's Asian Americans who are getting these low wages. So it's a huge civil rights issue. It's a women's issue, 55%. Of those minimum wage workers are women, and it's a family issue for families to be able to have an increase in their income. I can tell you, you all know this intuitively, probably know it from the data. Over the last few years, you know, CEOs have gotten nice bumps in their salaries. You know, shareholders are making great amounts of money. But the people at the bottom have had not had any increase at all. So it's only fair and just that we give working families an increase in their wages. That's what this is about. And I can tell you, with no uncertain terms, that this is something that will be talked about in the coffee shops, the workplaces all over America. Because what it means is for everyone, a raise. And again, it's not just people making $7.25 an hour. A lot of people say, well, that's just those, and they don't vote anyway, and they don't matter in the electoral process. Well, that's not so. Here's the point. 83% of the benefits of the 10-10 an hour accrue to families who have a family income of less than $60,000 a year. So you have families making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 to $60,000 a year that will get an increase in their wages. How does that work? Well, maybe you got two low-income people working on jobs. Maybe you've got one person working making $30,000 or $35,000 a year. The other person is working at a $7.25 an hour job. So that family gets an increase. So it's not just the lowest income people that are being helped. Middle class America gets a raise. And that's what we need to understand and why this is an issue that I say will be more potent in terms of electoral politics this year than any other thing we can vote on around here. Because it hits people right in their pocketbooks. You know, who are you for? Are you for giving families a raise? Or are you just for continuing to give the CEOs more money and the shareholders more money? Believe me, this is a voting issue. Now, I'd like to also say that a lot of people say, well, 10-10 may be too high. Maybe we need $9 or something like that. That's what the Republicans are kind of coming back with here, $9. Well, what we did is we looked at the poverty line. And in 1968, the minimum wage was, as soon as I find my right chart here, it was 120% of the poverty wage in 1968, 120%. Now it's 81% of the poverty wage. So we wanted to bring it up just above the poverty line and index it, so that never in the future would it ever fall below the poverty line again. And that came out, if you do 10-10, that comes out to be 107% of the poverty line. So this gets it above the poverty line, and we index it for the future. And that's how we arrived at that $10.10. The history and the increase. The increase is a 39% increase phased in over 3 years. The last time we increased it was 41%. That was in 2007, signed into law by a Republican president, George Bush. So we're in line historically with the increases. We get it just above the poverty level and index it there. That's why it's so important. And why it's so important that we don't settle for $9 or $9.50, because then you lock people in to a below poverty wage. And we don't want to do that. Now, the other thing we do in our bill that's so vitally important is we increase tip wages. The tip wage, I tell this to people, they don't think I'm telling them the truth. I say the minimum wage for tip workers is $2.13 an hour. People say that's impossible, that can't be right. But it's true. And it's been that way since 1991. Well, it's time to increase it. So our bill would increase it, not in 3 years, but over 6 years. It would raise it up to be 70% of the minimum wage, and then we index that so it stays there. I told my caucus today, in explaining a lot of this, I asked members of my Democratic caucus, do you know how you can be classified as a tipped worker? Not one person knows. Does anyone here know how you classify someone as a tipped worker? No one knew. And when I told them, they were amazed. I said, look, here's how you classify someone as a tipped worker under the law today. If you make more than $30 a month in tips, your employer can qualify you as a tipped worker. Think about that. 5 days a week, if you're working 20 days a month, that's a dollar and a half a day. If you get tips of a dollar and a half a day, your employer can say you're a tipped worker and I only got to pay you $2.13 an hour. That's bordering on criminality in our society today. So we want to get those tip wages up too. The most important thing we can do, I think, is to put it in human terms. Those are all just data points I wanted to give you and why it's so important to raise it. But I had a woman from Iowa in here to testify at my hearing on this. She has four boys and one set of twins. She was in a domestic violence situation in Illinois. She left that, came to Iowa with her boys. She was amazing. She's rebuilding her life. She's working hard. And here's what she said. She said, I ride a bus 20 miles each way every day to get to work. The bus only runs until 3 p.m., so she can only work about 20 to 25 hours a week. The bus costs her $10 a day. Now, she's trying to find an apartment closer to her job, but she's relying on public housing, and there aren't any options where she is. She doesn't own a car, so she has to take time off of work to go to the grocery store during the week when she's in town, and she can ride the bus. She only earns about $450 a month. Her expenses are about $600. And that's a bare-bones budget. Now, of course, what helps with that is Medicaid and food stamps and TANF and child care assistance. But as she said, I want to get off that. I want to work and make money and earn my way. Now, Alice McCrary was wonderful. She just, it just brought it home that there are so many millions of people like this in our society today. So it's families like Alicia's that need this legislation. I can't get this done without you. We're going to bring it up. I thought we were going to bring it up this week. We're getting backed up by the UI, Unemployment Extension. We're getting backed up next week. We're going to do the Paycheck Fairness Bill next Tuesday. On Thursday, we end the week, and we're out of here for 2 weeks for the Easter break. So maybe we'll file the cloture on it next week. We probably won't be on it until after we come back from Easter. And what day is that? That would be probably around the end of April. Yeah, probably right around the end of April, we'll have it on the floor. And we'll need cloture. We need 60 votes. And so, I don't know, the way it looks now, every Republican will vote against it. That's what they say, but now we got to turn up the heat. So we can't do this without you. You out there are vital to putting pressure on senators right now and representatives. The representatives aren't voting on it, but they can talk to their senators about the kind of pressure they're getting. So, all I can tell you is if we don't win it the first time, we'll be back, and we'll be back, and we'll be back. And I can assure you, if we don't win it in this Congress before November, we'll win in November when voters go to the ballot box and they vote for those candidates who supported a raise for hardworking Americans.
Wow. Well, Senator, you've given us a lot to think about. You have given us some really powerful data points. But you've also given us a compelling narrative of, a real person who is struggling to live off of a minimum wage and provide for her family in Iowa. And that's a powerful story. And I think the momentum that you're helping to create, your leadership in support of this minimum wage bill, is exactly what we need. And your persistence in helping to push your colleagues to take a definitive vote on this issue, to hear from their constituents back at home, is a good thing. In fact, that two-week break may actually work to our advantage because it gives us a chance to work members both at the grassroots level and at the grass tops level while they're at home, and we're going to hear a little bit about that as well. And I know your schedule is tight. I don't know if you can stay for a few minutes for questions, but we've also been joined while you were making your presentation by our dear friend Tom Perez, the U.S. Secretary of Labor. Tom, are you on the call?
Yes, I am, Wade.
Wonderful. I'm going to introduce you, and with Senator Harkin is okay, I'm going to ask you to give your remarks, and then I'd like to open up the floor for questions from our listeners, having both you, Tom, and you, Senator Harkin, on the call, as well as Chris Owen and Dara Richardson-Herod of the YWCA is just wonderful. And so let me introduce you, Tom, and then ask you to give a presentation, and we'll open it up briefly. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the great honor and the privilege of introducing another champion for civil and human rights, and really a longtime friend of the Leadership Conference, and that is U.S. Secretary of Labor, Tom Perez. Now, Secretary Perez has spent his entire career in public service. Before he was nominated and confirmed to head the Department of Labor under President Obama, Tom served as the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Justice. He's been an elected official in Montgomery County. He worked there as the Secretary of Labor in the state cabinet. And he has done many other things that have distinguished him as a servant of the people and as someone who understands the importance of the topics that we're talking about today. Tom has really helped define the minimum wage issue as an important civil rights issue. And so with no further ado, let us invite Tom to speak to the audience today. Tom?
Thank you so much, Wade, and thank you for your leadership on this and so many other issues. And I would be remiss if I didn't say my thanks to one of my heroes, Senator Harkin. It's a tribute to the breadth and depth of what he does. I was just with him 2 hours ago as we talked about the need to reduce child labor in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire in the cocoa industry. His footprint is global, and he has made a difference not only for American workers, but for people across the world. So thank you again, Senator Harkin, for your leadership. I'm going to be very brief because everybody on this call knows the issues, and I don't need to make the case on the minimum wage that Senator Harkin made so compellingly. I want to address some issues that I'm confident are on your mind. First of all, I want to say whether you're in the labor movement, a faith leader, a nonprofit leader, a business leader, an educator, or a low-wage worker, thank you. I've spoken to all of these various stakeholders, and I've been inspired by all of you, and I appreciate your leadership. And this is about building movements. And the first thing I want to address is the skepticism that some might feel. Oh, this will never get done. Washington doesn't do anything. Well, let's go back to 1996 for a moment. A lot of similarities. We had a government shutdown. You remember the Gingrich shutdown? And in the aftermath of that shutdown, there were people who were understandably angry with government, saying government can't get anything done. And then you overlay on that, the 96 was a presidential election year. So the conventional wisdom was you can never get anything done in the presidential election year. Well, what happened in 96? Immigration reform passed. Welfare reform passed. The minimum wage was increased. A hate crimes bill passed. Health insurance portability passed. Five important pieces of legislation, and there were actually a few more. This can be done, but it's only going to get done with your voices being heard. I remember vividly when the immigration bill was being debated, there was a provision that passed the House that would have, and it passed the House by a veto-proof majority, that would have given states the authority to kick undocumented kids out of school. It was a codification of Prop 187 from California. That provision was never even taken up in the Senate version of immigration reform, and that's because people like all of you on this phone rose up, formed a coalition, and said, this will not happen. And it did not happen. And that potentially horrific measure never saw the light of day after that point. And so I bring that up because I continue to have optimism that we can move forward in a very productive way, because we've got wonderful leaders in the form of Senator Harkin and Congressman Miller, and we've got wonderful advocates on this phone from a very eclectic group of stakeholders. And we've got the facts on our side. And when people tell you that this is a job killer, well, the facts belie that. And we have been I talk with as many business owners as anyone, and I'm always amazed at the number of business owners who understood exactly what Henry Ford understood 100 years ago when he doubled the wages for people on the assembly line. He had an attrition rate of over 300% at the time. It's really hard to run a business if you've got an attrition rate of 300%. And so by doubling the wages, he created a much more stable workforce. He reduced attrition. He increased loyalty. And he put money in people's pockets. And when people get money in their pockets, they spend it. And then businesses have to make more things, and they have to hire more people. And that is why this is so important. Because as one business owner said to me, the thing I need most, Tom, right now is customers. This has been a consumption-deprived recovery. And when we put more money in people's pockets, they spend it. And that is one of the many compelling reasons I have heard for raising the minimum wage. This president, he is going all around the country. He'll be in Ann Arbor tomorrow. We were in Connecticut a couple weeks ago, and a few days later, Governor Malloy led the effort to enact 1010 in Connecticut. State and local governments are going gangbusters. A brush fire turned into a prairie fire, and now it's a wildfire of fairness and opportunity. And we support those efforts because they're not inconsistent with what Senator Harkin and Congressman Miller are doing. They're very complementary. We should have a federal floor of 1010, and then state and local governments can augment it to reflect the cost of living differences in those areas. We're thrilled to be part of this effort. The president is in full bore, and we will continue to work hard. And if you need any information, you have great resources in NELP and Chris and others, and you should always feel free to contact us as well at the Department of Labor. So thanks, Wade, for letting me play a little bit of role here. We're going to continue to pound the pavement and shine a light on this important issue. And Senator Harkin, thank you for everything you do for vulnerable people.
Well, Mr. Secretary, thank you so much. Senator Harkin, thank you. And thanks to our other speakers, Chris Owen from the National Employment Law Project, Richardson Heron from the YWCA. And we have an audience that has been listening in now for about an hour. They have been a wonderfully patient audience. Everyone was excited to have Senator Harkin and Tom Perez on the call today, as well as our other speakers. But because they have listened so patiently, perhaps you wouldn't mind taking just a few questions from the audience that's listening in. Justin, could we take just a couple of questions, please?
No problem. And if you would like to ask a question, it is star and one on your touchtone telephone. And I'll pause momentarily to allow questions to queue.
Thank you.
Hey, wait, I just want you to know I'm up. I heard Tom's wonderful.
Wonderful. Well, Senator, I know you're jammed, and so you may have to leave momentarily, but I wanted to make sure that one or two questions at least were available for you to answer if you were okay with that.
I'm okay. I'm just fine.
Great. Justin, do we have anyone on the line?
Again, to ask a question, it is star and one.
Okay. Well, while we're waiting, Senator, do you have any closing remarks? I mean, again, I think you have really inspired us. You've given us a sense of real confidence. I'm optimistic that with the kind of pressure we can generate, and when people go home over the Easter break, really targeting those phone calls to their Senate offices, their senators, I think will make a huge difference. But I want to invite you to make any closing remarks in case you have to leave.
Well, we're way below a poverty wage for minimum wage workers in this country, and it's time to get it above it.
Yeah.
And now a lot of people say, well, you know, there's other programs like food stamps and TANF and stuff. Taxpayers today are supporting low-wage workers to the tune of about $240 billion a year. So what we're doing is we're supporting people with taxpayers' money so that they can be paid less. That doesn't make sense to me. Now, I can't say that we're going to save all of that money by raising the minimum wage, but I do have one data point, and we can calculate food stamps. If we raise the minimum wage to $10.10, we're going to save $4.6 billion in the first year of taxpayers' money just on food stamps.
Wow.
Imagine that.
Wow.
And that means people have enough money to buy their own food. They won't qualify for food stamps. So that's $4.6 billion a year. So if you got some conservative friends and want to cut government spending, this is one way to do it. So my closing thing would be, look, I think we're at a key point in time here. It's now getting out in the public. People are thinking about it. They know that wages have been stagnant, and I don't mean just minimum wages. Wages across the board have been stagnant. And here's one way for them to get their wages increased without relying on government assistance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So to me, that's the key, and I just thank you so much, Wade, and the leadership conference.
Great advice. Well, thank you, Senator, so much, and thank you so much for joining us on the call. Justin, before we bring our call to a close, do you have any questions from anyone in the audience?
We did have one question from Shirley Lee with the Equal Opportunity Professional Services. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
This question is to Senator Tom Harkin. With respect to the indexing in the future as it relates to the minimum wage, are there specific dates in place for future increases? And also, will employers be sanctioned if they fail to comply when the bill passes? And what type of sanctions?
Yeah, sure. Basically, we want to get above the poverty line and then index it for inflation in the future so that it never falls below the poverty line. And by the way, I just might want to say that when you hear someone say, well, maybe we should raise it to $9 or $9.50 and index it, that would be indexing for the future a below poverty wage, and we will not do that. So, yes, it gets it above it, and in the future, if employers did not comply with that, of course, we have our Department of Labor, our wage and hour division there, that will enforce this in the future, just like the enforce minimum wage laws today. So, yes, there are sanctions in there. We do have a wage and hour division at the Department of Labor, and, again, we have a wonderful Secretary of Labor that doing everything to enforce this. In fact, we're going to have a new head of the wage and hour division, I hope, soon to help him carry out those functions. So the answer to your question is yes, there are sanctions and penalties if employers don't comply in the future.
Well, thank you, Senator. Ladies and gentlemen, we are close to the 5:30 time that we had set to end this call. But before we bring it to a close, I want to ask Anjali Thacker-Mittal, who is the Deputy Field Director here at the Leadership Conference, to talk a bit about some of the resources that we have available to you and to help support your advocacy on this issue. Anjali?
Sure. Thank you so much, Wade. If it's okay, Wade, we actually have a question for Secretary Perez. I know that.
Oh, wonderful. Yes,
I know someone was having difficulty getting in the queue, so I'll just go ahead and relay the question. It's from Francois Jacobson with Legal Momentum.
Okay.
And the question is, Secretary Perez, thank you so much for all of your work to raise the minimum wage and support the economic security of so many people, especially women who are over 35% more likely to be poor and more likely to be earning lower wages than men. Another way to address women's poverty is to look at occupational segregation in high-wage, high-demand occupations such as construction work. Is there a plan to include women in non-traditional occupations in your upcoming Working Families Summit?
Great short question.
The great question, and the short answer is absolutely. I was out in San Francisco a couple weeks ago. I was in an IBEW location looking at their apprenticeship program, and there's a woman, Jessica, who was there that I met, who is a wonderful example of women in a traditionally male occupation. Jessica's making about $80,000 a year, and she is a remarkable journey person who is, as a result of having gone through that apprenticeship program, is really set for life. And those are the things that we need to be highlighting and amplifying and working to ensure that those barriers are broken down. And that's why we're spending a lot of time in that area. We're also working with returning veterans who are women. And we had a very good session here 2 or 3 months ago with a number of key stakeholders to make sure that we created robust career pathways for women leaving the armed forces so that they can get whatever job is what their dreams are and what their talents are.
Wow. Fantastic. Well, those questions were great, and thanks to those of you who put them forth. I'm going to again invite Anjali Thacker-Mittal to close us out. She is our Deputy Field Director here at the Leadership Conference and can offer some discussion about resources we have available. Anjali?
Thank you so much, Wade. As all of our speakers have been really eloquent in explaining and emphasizing and really helping us, you know, feel the energy of this movement and the time right now, it is a time to make our voices heard on this important issue. And as partners to you, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights can offer you assistance in a couple of concrete ways. First, we've developed an online action alert that includes a toll-free dial-in number. It was the same number that Chris Owens had mentioned earlier, and it's supplied by our friends at AFSCME. And you can use this number to contact your senators ahead of the vote in the Senate. Our action alert can be found on www.civilrights.org/actioncenter. We'll also send it out following the call. We also have developed a series of fact sheets to assist you in your advocacy efforts with your members of Congress that also has specific data for different communities. And then lastly, you'll receive a follow-up email shortly with links to the action alert, the fact sheet, and additional advocacy tools. And as always, the field staff at the Leadership Conference is here as a resource if you have any questions about how you can plug in to the campaign efforts. And you can follow up with either myself or Beth Sadler at grassroots@civilrights.org.
Anjali, thank you. And again, let's give that phone number that our listeners can use to contact their Senate offices. It's 1-866-851-1916. Is that correct?
Wait, it's actually 1-888.
Ooh, sorry. Okay, 1-888. Let's give that again. My apologies.
Yeah, 1-888-851-1916.
Mm-hmm.
1916.
Okay. One more time.
1-888-851-1916.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate that. And really, let me thank all of our speakers this afternoon. Senator Tom Harkin, Democrat from Iowa, the sponsor of the Senate minimum wage bill. U.S. Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, who is doing such an outstanding job in advocating for this important issue. Chris Owen, Executive Director of the National Employment Law Project. And Dara Richardson-Heron, CEO and President of the YWCA USA. Thank you all for joining us on this call, and thanks most importantly to those of you who dialed in. We know how important this issue is to you and to your constituents back at home. We really appreciate your leadership and your support, and we really hope that together we're going to be able to drive this change home in Congress this year. So thanks again for joining us on the call, and we look forward to celebrating on the victory on raising the minimum wage. Thanks again, everyone. And Justin, thank you. This should be the end of the call.